New York City, 1975. I felt I was only treading water in Australia. Adelaide had few prospects for either a young artist or a young musician. It had launched a decent number of prominent people, but had not managed to be large enough to retain or nurture many. Robert Helpman, Robert Stigwood, Rupert Murdoch, Jeffrey Smart were all born in South Australia, but had to move away to thrive. I was compelled to go, and somehow the door had been opened up. I'd had the financial backing of a $4,000 Australia Council grant I received a few weeks before. Because of the favourable exchange rate in 1975, that became almost US$5,000. That was a good amount of money for even New York at that time. I was enrolled at the School of Visual Arts on 209 East 23rd Street. In early August 1975, I boarded the UTA Boeing 747 from Sydney, Australia to Los Angeles. I had a $400 one-way ticket. There was a four-hour stop in Tahiti, where we were taken on buses to a shady beach for a couple of hours to sip cool drinks. Then on to Los Angeles. I lost myself in Patrick White's novel Voss, about explorers venturing the vast Australian outback. The eerie lostness of White's characters was relevant to my current situation and unanchoring from all that I knew to face an unknown prospect of America, a frightening and exciting proposition. Landing in Los Angeles, I passed through customs with no problem, having secured a student visa. Disorientated and jet-lagged, I still had a seven-hour flight to New York. My conversations on the flight consisted of warnings about the crime in the city. I landed at JFK, collected my bags, then found a taxi to take me to my pre-booked hotel in Times Square, the Times Square Motor Hotel. Without internet, I must have had the assistance of a travel agent to secure my booking. The taxi ride was about 45 minutes, during which the white New York driver realized I was young, green, and a newcomer to New York. He proceeded to set me on edge. "Watch out for black guys wearing sneakers," he said. "They wear sneakers so they can rob you and run fast," he said matter-of-factly. It was 11 a.m., a very warm, humid day with hazy skies over Manhattan. The huge city appeared like an artificial mountain range in the distance. Next, the Twin Towers and the Empire State Building defined the skyline, assuring me where I was in the land of Midnight Cowboy. I'd watched this movie when it was released in 1969. It had a profound impact on me. Somehow it served as an educational tool. The yellow cab pulled up in the heart of sleazy Times Square, featured so prominently in Midnight Cowboy. My hotel had recently been used to house Manhattan's mentally ill. As I alighted from the cab and grabbed my bags, a prostitute approached me. "How about a good time, honey?" she propositioned. I wearily answered, "No, thanks. All I wanted was a good rest, not a good time, whatever that involved," at 11 a.m. I checked into my room, locked the door, unpacked, then showered. I climbed on the bed of the old hotel room, switched on the TV. It was so different from the more formal, sedate fare served up on the Australian tube. Things were sharper, more insistent, engaging and seductive. The commercials were even fascinating. I watched for a while before falling into a very long sleep. 16 hours later, I woke up totally dehydrated and disorientated. In 1975, Manhattan was in a low point. Mayor Abe Beame was having difficulty managing a city that was falling apart. A large portion of Manhattan's middle class found Manhattan too violent, too run down. They were leaving in droves for the suburbs to Queens, Staten Island, Long Island, and upstate New York. Tax revenue plummeted and basic city bills couldn't be covered. The Rolling Stones were ensconced and enamored with Manhattan. They wrote an ode to New York in their song Hot Stuff from their 1976 Black and Blue album.
All the people in New York says, "I know you're going broke, but I know you're tough.
All the people in New York City, I know you're going broke, but you're tough. You're hot. Hot stuff."
a statement of power and wealth, the Twin Towers dominated the city. They were opened in 1973 and featured in Dino De Laurentiis' movie King Kong in 1976. My booking at the Times Square Motor Hotel was for 3 nights. I was overwhelmed by the reality of Manhattan, of Times Square. It looked familiar because of the movies, but in reality was very alien. People seemed taller than me, with more urgent business than mine. They moved fast. They didn't notice me. The number of steak places, pizza places, beer and food joints was everything one could want, block after block. I walked during daylight, then retreated to my hotel before dark, speaking to no one. I took myself to see the Rockettes perform a matinee session at the Radio City Music Hall on 6th Avenue and 50th Street. I watched the long line of beauties high kick and dance their way through the pop numbers of the moment, culminating with their dance to Barry White's Love Theme. I had a brief time to organize my next move. Times Square was too much of an assault on my small city innocence. I'd heard that there was short-term accommodation available at Columbia University on the Upper West Side. I contacted the university and successfully organized a 10-day stay in the student dorm. This proved a good move, giving me the chance to acclimatize without too much central overload. Clement Meemore was the only name that I had for a contact in New York City. He was recommended by David Dowitz, my South Australian art school teacher, mentor and friend. Clement had moved to New York City from Sydney in 1963, making a successful stand there, even becoming an American citizen. He made huge sculptures of twisted steel and bronze. Clement lived on the Upper West Side in a sprawling, comfortable apartment. I phoned him and he invited me to come and visit for lunch. He had an imposing, impressive stereo, a large record collection, and a piano. Jazz music played smoothly in the background. Clement fulfilled his obligation to his Adelaide friend David Dowitz. He ordered a Chinese takeout for lunch, chatted with me for an hour, then handed me a 50-cent subway token, suggesting that this was the key to getting around Manhattan. He was right, of course. Up till then, I'd been walking everywhere or catching a bus. It was all above ground. It felt safer. I'd walk up and down the avenues, along and through Central Park. It was summer. I knew nobody. Central Park was refreshing and beautiful. Strains of the latest radio hits flowed from beatboxes, providing a soundtrack. I'm not in love, so don't forget it. It's just a silly phase I'm going through. I'm not in love, so don't forget it. Me and Mrs. Jones, we got a thing.
Me and Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on.
Behind me, people were conversing in French, Italian, Spanish, Yiddish, New Yorkese. The familiar accents of home were not heard. I felt I was an observer, not really part of all this humanity. I liked the Upper West Side. It was so much more relaxed than the stressed-out Times Square zone. There were trees, places to sit and relax. There were friendlier corner stores, corner bars, and no strip clubs or triple X cinemas. I used my time at Columbia University to acclimatize to Manhattan. The grounds of the university were relaxing. The students weren't back yet. It was mid-August. I had my first Budweiser beer in the student bar. It was light, cold, and refreshing. I talked to almost no one during my stay. I had to find a more permanent accommodation and settle myself. My studies at the School of Visual Arts were due to start in less than 2 weeks. I found a place to stay by looking at the School of Visual Arts student notice board. An illustration student needed someone to share his one-bedroom apartment on West 79th Street. I got the fold-out bed in the living room. It was okay for a while, but it wasn't going to work long-term. I didn't have much privacy. The neighbors were noisy. A single mother yelled at her son each morning to get out of bed and get to school. Her son complained. Mom, she yelled louder. At least I had someone to talk to now. My roommate came from Long Island. He showed me the Upper West Side and took me once to hang out with his friends on Long Island. We didn't spend too much time together, as we didn't have a lot in common. I impulsively purchased an upright piano after a couple of weeks. Being of the age where anything's possible, I decided to teach myself piano and play in small Manhattan clubs. I explored chords and floundered with melodies for an hour or two each day. I felt I was getting somewhere. One evening, over pizza, it was clear my roommate wanted to share something with me. "Can I tell you something?" he asked. "Yeah, sure, what is it?" I responded. "I think I'm gay," he said cautiously. I hadn't seen this coming. There were no signs. He just seemed like a reserved guy from the burbs. I answered to the best of my ability that it was what it was. I wasn't sure if I had anything to offer except an ear to hear. I didn't get the feeling that I was in his sights, but I was someone for him to test this new possible identity on. Still, it was a turning point, letting me know that it was time to find my own place. I'd been there a month. When I mentioned I was going to look for my own place, my roommate told me how hard it would be to find an apartment. When told how difficult something is, I tend to do it just to prove that it isn't hard. Looking through the classifieds, I noticed an apartment for rent on West 24th Street for $175 a month. This is a perfect location, within walking distance of my art school. I found my way there. It was between 6th and 7th Avenues, an old narrow building, 7 stories high. I rang the superintendent's buzzer and was soon met by the owner of the building, Ken Diamondstone. Ken looked a little like Cat Stevens with his dark, longish, curly hair. I followed him up the 6 flights of stairs, no elevator, to the apartment for rent. It was in disrepair with plaster rubble on the floor. It was clearly not ready for renting. "It'll be another week or so," Ken said. "If you want it, you can have it then." I was impressed with the location, with the privacy, the light, and the space of the old apartment. I wanted to move right in. How about I move in now? I'll clean up the mess and paint the apartment. You can give me some free rent, perhaps, in exchange," I suggested. Ken was surprised at my offer, but he was not one to turn down free labor. "That sounds like a workable deal. I'll give you 2 weeks rent-free if you clean it up and make it livable," he said. We shook hands. I returned to West 79th Street to pack my things. The big item I had to move was the piano I'd bought 2 weeks before. Reality kicked in. The 79th Street apartment was only one flight up with wide stairs. The 24th Street apartment was 6 flights of narrow stairs. Still, I was young, stubborn, and without much experience. I booked a couple of movers to come by and collect the piano, which worked well. The problem came at the 24th Street end. Once the piano was unloaded, the impossibility of the task became instantly evident. The two movers gave an initial try, but it was clearly not going to happen. The piano was then pushed back onto the street, and the $50 moving payment was demanded. I paid it, then stood by the bulky, forlorn instrument, deciding the only option was to sell it now on the street. The street was moderately busy with passers-by. As people passed me, some would slow down and look at the piano and then at me. Once I saw there was a little interest, I'd say, "Hey, I'm selling this piano if you're interested at all." It didn't take more than 30 minutes and a dozen or so solicitations to find a buyer. I got my $50 back, but lost my piano and my budding piano bar career. The guy who bought it worked about 3 doors down the street and was able to push it to his building for safekeeping, then transport it home later. I was drained after moving into my new but messed up apartment and having to sell my piano on the street. I decided to take myself to lunch nearby. I was hungry and tired. It was about 2 p.m. and hot. Being Manhattan, there's always lots of options. I found an Indian restaurant. The lunch hour rush was over and I was the only customer. It was a small place. I sat down and ordered a simple dal and rice from the waiter who went back to the kitchen. Right after that, a man in a uniform hurried in to find the waiter. He went to the back and angry words were exchanged. The men were yelling at each other. "Give me my money," screamed the uniformed man who just entered. "Get out," the waiter shouted back. "You never got rid of the cockroaches." "I did my job. I want my money," the uniformed man shouted back. Suddenly it escalated. The waiter had a meat cleaver, which he was waving at the uniformed man. He was really threatening him, and then chasing him out towards the door as he yelled, "Don't come back! Get out!" I was invisible to both of them, feeling transfixed but very uncomfortable. I took the opportunity to slide out and looked elsewhere for my nourishment. I discovered there was an excellent, very cheap Hispanic cafe directly below my building, on the street. It became my very regular eating place, where I mostly feasted on simple but delicious rice and beans. Meanwhile, I had the task of cleaning, painting, and revamping my apartment. It took me a week, but once it was done, I had a large, private, sunny space to live and work in. My landlord, Ken, came back to check on it when I'd finished. He was clearly impressed. He looked it over almost with disbelief that I'd worked so thoroughly and so fast. I built my own bed, breakfast table, and bench, and even took the liberty to paint my floor enamel red and yellow. Ken visited me a few more times as I settled in, and it wasn't long after that Ken brought up the possibility of employing me part-time to do odd jobs in his buildings, and even considered me later to take on the job as superintendent of the 24th Street building. My neighborhood was known as Chelsea. One block away was the famous Chelsea Hotel. Between my block and the Empire State Building was the Flower District and the Garment District. Warehouses bustled with workers pushing trolleys of flowers or racks of clothes into waiting vans. "Watch your back," they'd say. My block had a mix of warehouses and apartment buildings. The closest supermarket, Key Foods, was on 8th Avenue and 26th Street. This area had housing projects and a larger Puerto Rican mix to it. Art school began at the start of September. It was a 15-minute walk from my place. I walked down 6th Avenue to 23rd Street, crossed 5th Avenue, Broadway, and Park, past the Flatiron Building, and over to 3rd Avenue. Initially, I'd been given only 1 year's credit towards my 4-year fine arts degree. Within a few weeks, however, the lecturers conceded that I deserved to be put ahead to 3rd year. The large, bustling institution made me feel both inspired and sheltered from the enormity of life outside. I had a world to focus on and a structure to follow. The School of Visual Arts had an amazing staff of established artists to choose from. Donald Cuspert taught art history, Louise Bourgeois and Joel Shapiro taught sculpture. Students could choose a teacher whose work related to theirs. For drawing, I had Herbert Katzman, a fabulous draftsman. I chose Sylvia Mangold, a solid realist, for painting, and for another, I chose John Button. These established artists all had major galleries in New York. John was an inspiring teacher, full of energy and enthusiasm. His own work was a painterly realist style, depicting mainly city scenes. He featured skies inspired by Rothko and Caspar David Friedrich. John Button was generally thrilled with the progress of his students. He built them up and gave them a sense of self-respect and achievement. He introduced me to the work of other important, influential painters such as Alfred Leslie, John Moore, and Philip Perlstein. He was full of information and encouragement. I never missed a class of his. He took me back to the joy I experienced when I first attended David Dryden's classes at St. Peter's College when I was 13. During the settling in period, I wandered farther afield, mostly walking, venturing downtown to explore the village, Bleecker Street, Washington Square, and discover Bleecker Bob's Records on West 3rd Street. St. Mark's Place also had great record stores, bars, and clothing shops. I'd lunch at Mamus Falafel on McDougal Street for a couple of dollars. I still knew almost no one in New York City, so my days were spent quietly discovering Manhattan by myself. I discovered a huge record fair one weekend and saw a new band promoted on a large TV screen. They were a nervous, nerdy bunch called Talking Heads. I'd heard that Frank Sinatra was to perform in the city. I was a huge fan. I inherited this from my dad. Just before I flew out of Australia, I spent a few days with Pam, an art school girlfriend in Adelaide. We'd spend hours together listening mostly to Frank, to his recent 1973 album, Old Blue Eyes Is Back. It was our soundtrack, washing over us as the time for me to go pressed on. Here was my opportunity to see Frank in person, and it wasn't all that hard to secure a ticket. He was appearing at the Eurus Theatre on 51st Street for several nights. The venue was relatively small with a perfect view and sound from any seat. The concert itself was a dream. Count Basie led a huge orchestra, Ella Fitzgerald opened, then Frank came on. The whole experience was one of utter perfection and professionalism. The power and precision of Basie Orchestra was incredible. Then the vocals of Ella were added to lift things to astounding heights. When Frank took the stage, it peaked with pure charisma and musical command. Ella joined Frank after he'd sung a dozen songs, including Let Me Try Again, Something, Didn't We, Send in the Clowns, and together they performed The Song Is You and They Can't Take That Away From Me. It was simply the best live musical experience I'd ever witnessed, and still it remains. Even though I'd seen amazing acts such as The Who in Adelaide in 1968, Led Zeppelin in Adelaide 72, and The Rolling Stones in 1973. I bought a turntable and began collecting albums. Music kept me company. Being alone, I listened to vocalists singing melancholy songs. Edie Gourmet, Sinatra, Tony Bennett. Art school had begun and my social situation slowly improved. My first friend was a dark-haired, tall, hip young painting student named Steve Pollock. Steve was sharp-dressed and quick-witted. He was an uply aspirational guy. He noticed that I was not a typical art student from Queens or Long Island, that I spoke and dressed differently. He wanted to see what made me tick. He was the first to strike up a conversation. We soon found out that we had a lot in common musically. Ken offered me the job as superintendent of the building. This entailed being available for any of the tenants' emergencies, listening to their complaints, and note any faults they encountered. It was my job to sweep and mop the six flights of stairs and all the hallways. I had to put out the trash each week and keep things generally tidy. Ken still wanted me to pay $25 a month after all these tasks. I guess he just wanted a little extra pocket money. Still, my monthly financial load decreased considerably. I was aware that after all my expenses, the flight, the rents, the art school fees, and my day-to-day existence, I'd need to find ways to make extra money. My comfortable pool of grant money was gradually diminishing. My first job outside my building was as a janitor for my art school. There was a permanent team of about five janitors and elevator operators, and they were assisted by a couple of students who needed part-time work. The permanent janitors and elevator operators were all black. They were slow and steady, not letting anything much ruffle them. I enjoyed my conversations with them. One guy, about 50, took more of a liking to me. He told me about how he enjoyed his weekends and he loved a big bottle of Ballantine beer or two. He got to hear a bit about Australia. He had the idea that Australia didn't like black people. It seemed to derive from the soldiers' experiences he'd heard of in the Second World War. I hoped I'd given him a better impression. Towards the end of that year, my art school girlfriend and fellow Sinatra lover, Pam, arrived to visit me. Pam came from Adelaide. She had relations in Chicago. She visited them first, then caught a train to New York to see me. Our time in Adelaide had been intensely close for a few days before I flew out. We'd been tentatively checking each other out for a year or more before that. We even wrote to each other when I lived in Sydney for a few months. Our connection was a strange, dreamy one, partly poetic. It wasn't my normal romantic connection. Pam was very much a dreamer, in the head, while I was more physically and primarily attracted to a lover. Before Pam arrived, I wasn't sure where our relationship was headed. I wasn't sure what Pam expected, nor was I sure what I wanted. I did know that I was glad to leave behind the limitation I felt in Adelaide and in Australia. I felt fear that things might become serious with Pam and I'd be surrendering my newfound independence. I'd be rejoined to something Australian and something that was possibly limiting to me. When I met Pam, all these fears manifested. I froze. I shut down, unable to verbalize my feelings. I went cold. It must have been awful for Pam. She wasn't able to open me up to talking about it, and I simply didn't understand what I was doing. We never got close, nor made love, even though we slept in my bed together. It became unbearable after a couple of days. I felt terrible on every level. I had to ask Pam to stay at a hotel for a couple of days in Manhattan. I saw her to a hotel, gave her a hug and a kiss, and never saw her again until several years later when we caught up for an afternoon, but still we never discussed what happened in Manhattan. I was uncomfortably affected, however, and I wrote and recorded a song about the experience, which I called Smile or a Tear. You haven't changed a bit since you've been gone.
You haven't changed a bit since you've been gone.
Strangely, for someone 21 years old, in 1975, who'd been in four pop rock bands, I'd become immersed in the music of crooners and jazz singers. I was trying to write and sing songs that were the turf of Sinatra, Bennett, etc. This genre wasn't on the radar for audiences of my age at that time. I had the chutzpah to head to a midtown piano bar and ask the piano guy if I could sing a song. I requested to sing L-O-V-E, Love.
L is for the way you look at me.
A couple of people came in from the adjoining room, curious as to what I was singing or who was singing. Christmas 1975. My brother Stephen visited me in December 1975. I just turned 22. Stephen was 26. It had been lonely sometimes in this massive city, so I appreciated the company, even though my brother and I were never very close. During my first year in New York, I considered leaving and perhaps moving to Italy. After that, I began to feel a part of the city, and moving wasn't on my radar anymore. Stephen's interests were mostly things of pleasure, food, alcohol, movies, sex, and luxury. Stephen delighted in the raw, sleazy looseness of Manhattan. On my corner, a half a block from my building, was Billy's Topless, one of the multitude of topless bars around Manhattan. It was peaking around the time in New York when the headline read, Headless Body in a Topless Bar, in 1983. With my brother's encouragement, visits to the dark side of Times Square, the more wholesome Billy's Topless, along with other similar bars, became commonplace. We planned to drive down to Miami, Florida, over the Christmas period. I didn't have a car, of course, but there was a little company I'd heard of called Akon. This connected drivers with cars that needed to be delivered across the country. The car was free to drive, but it had to be delivered to its owner within a certain time frame, in this case, 3 days. We were allocated a 1974 Dodge Dart. It took a bit of adjustment to get used to the American roads and rules, but we settled in remarkably smoothly. On Christmas Day, we arrived in Atlanta, Georgia, had lunch at a Chinese restaurant, then headed to a bar near the motel that we'd chosen. The bar was a local hangout and looked a little rough. As we pulled up, so did another car. A couple of guys climbed out. One pulled out something longish wrapped in a long towel and hid it behind a bush before entering the bar. We clearly stood out from the regulars. So much so that within seconds of walking through the door, we heard someone say loudly, "You guys ain't from New York, are you?" It didn't matter that we're from Australia. It was New York that was the enemy down south. All eyes were on us, and one of the regulars approached us, then invited us to a party. Stephen and I knew something felt very wrong. One of the guys who'd hidden the long object outside encouraged us to follow him to the party. He went out and retrieved the mystery object, put it in his vehicle again. We kept them thinking that we were going to go along with them. We finished our beers, then to our car, and quickly zoomed straight to the motel without incident. We made a successful journey to Miami, delivered the car, and caught a Greyhound bus back to New York City, an excruciating trip lasting over 2 days. My brother stayed for a couple of weeks before heading back to London, where he was starting to establish himself in the law game. For the first year, Steve Pollock was my most consistent friend. He lived in a loft space on the lower Far East Side, an area not considered desirable by the regular Manhattan inhabitants. It was gradually being discovered by artists, however. Steve moved into a loft vacated by painter Janet Fish after her career was rising. and she discovered better quarters on Spring Street, Soho. Steve and I often met in Washington Square Park. We'd sit on a bench watching all the activity around, making plans while sharing a joint purchased from one of the dealers on the street or in the park itself. Nickel bags, dime bags, uppers, downers, the dealers offered as the prospects passed. The Lou Rawls hit, "You'll Never Find," serenaded the park dwellers.
You'll never find.
Steve had a job nearby on 6th Avenue at Bagel Nosh. It was a pretty cool job in a large, relaxed environment full of tempting food, which sometimes Steve managed to get me for free. Somehow the manager knew the prominent music promoter, Sid Bernstein. Sid first brought the Beatles to America, then he managed the Young Rascals. I brought an acetate of my Australian recordings with me to New York. Through Steve's connection to the Bagel Nosh manager, I was asked to submit my recordings to Sid Bernstein for consideration. He was handling a new Scottish band called the Bay City Rollers, and they were looking for new material to record. I had a song I'd written about the woman Nikki who pounced on me in Adelaide when I was with the Slim Pickens band. It was called Hold Me, Roll Me. Bernstein liked the song, but it didn't make it into the recording studio for the Rollers. The close connection to fame, however, encouraged me. I felt it wouldn't be long until something big did happen. Steve introduced me to a young friend of his named Jesse Chamberlain. Jesse was 17, perhaps 18. Steve said he was a fabulous drummer. He lived downtown in the Warehouse District at 67 Vestry Street in a sprawling loft with his dad, John Chamberlain. John was a well-established American art world famous sculptor. He didn't so much as sculpt as he crushed pre-existing forms, mostly car bodies. In John's huge studio area of the loft were a pile of car door panels, hoods, and side panels in various colors and states of deterioration. There was a large crushing machine next to the body parts. This is where John fed the sections and panels into. He could manipulate the amount of crushing with relative ease. The front half of the loft was an open living area. The building housed another artist on the level below, Marisol, a French-born pop sculptress. Jesse had his drums set up in the basement area of the building and was very keen to play with any musicians. He would switch between rock, jazz, and funk effortlessly. He had his mind made up to be part of a successful band and was anxious to begin the journey. We jammed and got along well. Jesse knew some other musicians, and with their help, we recorded a couple of my jazz songs at a small 8-track studio called Right Track Studio. The recording session was done on a warm night in the spring of 1976. Jesse recruited the assistance of a brilliant piano player. Steve played bass and guitar. Steve's sister, Annie, played flute. I had a bit of a crush on Annie. She was easygoing, talented, and good-looking with a long, curly blonde mane. I did my best Sinatra, Billie Holiday-inspired vocals and felt rather pleased with the final mix. Somehow the musical team, who played with me, also had confidence in the project. I submitted the finished tape of two songs to the New York record producer, John Hammond. I received a polite rejection letter a couple of weeks later and decided that my jazz days were over, even before they started. Who was I to bring ice to the Eskimos? New York had the greatest jazz singers and players in the world. I needed to reset my direction. Jesse reached out to find more musicians and soon introduced Steve and me to an Englishman named Andy Gray. Andy had a vision, a sort of working-class rock guy writing simple songs. Andy seemed to assemble the band around him. He gave the band their name, Endgame. Andy sung the songs, mostly his, and played guitar. He was a passable player, but not outstanding. Steve played bass, Jesse drums, of course, Annie joined us with flute. I really didn't fit in. Normally the role of lead singer went to me, but with Endgame, Andy took most of the action. He would be happy if I was out of the picture, but I sort of came with a drummer and a bass player, so he awkwardly tried to fit me in. I got to sing a couple of my songs, as well as sing backup and play a bit of flute. The person who takes the job of leader of the band usually bears most of the weight. This is why bands fall apart so easily. One carries most of the responsibilities and the rest of the band acts like bratty children, and before long they resent the leader. Andy organized some little gigs downtown, one at the wine bar, and Andy handed me Steve's bass guitar and told me just to play the next song while Steve played guitar. Having never played bass before, and being very rudimentary on regular guitar, I fumbled my way through the short song, turning a deep beetroot color. It was awkward and typical of Andy's direction with Endgame, haphazardness. He got us a spot at CBGB on a Sunday audition night. Bands who did well on audition night were given a real booking. I was allowed to sing a couple of songs, one of which was a jazz-tinged original of mine called Too Many Movies. Jesse's dad, John Chamberlain, was in the crowd and said later that that was his favourite song from our set. Endgame limped along for a few more weeks. Somehow Andy managed to contact David Byrne, suggesting that we might be the perfect opening act for the Talking Heads, who are now big business. Byrne turned up at the Vestry Street rehearsal room to watch us perform a few songs. Andy sung all the material. Byrne sat patiently through four or five numbers, then he left after saying something non-committal to Andy. Endgame had come to the end of its game. I became closer friends with Jesse. He lent me a bike to get around Manhattan. I was invited over to his loft sometimes, even when we weren't playing music. His dad was dating Frank Zappa's ex-girlfriend. One time he played the video of the popular porn film Deep Throat on his big television. Being well ingrained in the New York art scene, John was a popular guest at parties. He invited Jesse and me along to a big party thrown by Armand, the French-American artist who combines found objects of one kind to create a piece of art, such as violins. As a treat to his teenage son, John broke out his supply of cocaine to share with us before we headed off to the party. I'd never tried cocaine before and I was wary. I realized it was a quick high and could easily be addictive. John made some lines with the white powder, rolled a $20 bill and handed it to Jesse, then me. Something told me this wasn't a drug I wanted clinging onto me. The effect was fast, making me feel edgy, sort of above things. It was a ride that lasted until we reached the party. I felt disconnected from the arty New York guests, but enjoyed the strange experience anyway. New York was full of drugs. They surfaced more the longer I remained. Walking one night with Steve and Jesse back to Jesse's Vestry Street warehouse, on an almost empty street, a car cruised past us. Jesse responded to the vehicle's presence by giving a loud woohoo. Surprisingly, the car's occupants reacted. The car braked, then reversed to within a close range of us. Out sprang two angry thugs striding towards us. I was in a frozen state, perhaps having flashbacks to violent family confrontations. Steve and Jesse instinctively ran off. One of the thugs hovered over me as I looked at him, not moving. He loaded his fist and then plunged it into my right eye. I should have reeled backwards and fallen, but somehow I held my ground and stared him down. He decided more force was needed, and he ran back to the boot of his car, producing a tire iron. That was it. This looked really serious now. I ran to find my sensibly cowardly friends. I ran to the local diner to find my stressed-out friends there. The next day, my eye blackened like a catfish on the grill. Art school kept me focused. I took it seriously, applying myself and enjoying the competition of my talented peers. Students got to choose who they studied with. The School of Visual Arts had an impressive roster of successful artists. I worked hard during my first year at the School of Visual Arts, where I was credited with 2 years towards my four-year Bachelor of Art degree. It was inspiring to be living in New York City amongst so many purposefully creative people. It seemed that every waiter was a musician or an artist. The commercial galleries I regularly visited were on 57th Street, a 20-minute walk from my 24th Street apartment. Marlborough, Fishback, and Frumpkin galleries were my favorites because they exhibited the figurative artists that I admired, and in some cases I knew. Alice Neal, Alex Katz, Lois Dodd, Neil Welliver, Janet Fish, Al Leslie, John Button, and Philip Perlstein were some of the painters I admired. Skowhegan, 1976. I'd been obtaining excellent results in all my art classes. John Button particularly encouraged me. He told me about an opportunity available to young artists over the coming summer. It was a program called the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, based in Maine. A 9-week program running from mid-June to August that had been running since 1947. It took 60 young artists from across the country, housed, fed, and taught them. The fees were beyond my reach, but John said that 2 scholarships were available to students attending the School of Visual Arts. I applied, then waited. To my shock and delight, I received news that I had been awarded one of these scholarships. It was the only way I would have been able to attend. Once I received news I was accepted, John took me to meet a 4th-year painting student who received the School of Visual Arts full scholarship. He was a serious-looking guy named Hilary Zaricki. Hilary wore a button-down casual shirt. His black hair was combed back in a tidy style, revealing a large forehead. His workmanlike realist paintings were of the city. Hilary regarded me skeptically, not sure what was expected of him from this third-year foreign painter. I hadn't left the buildings and streets of Manhattan in nearly a year, apart from a brief drive to Florida. It was arranged that I'd get a lift from 2 other students. The trip to Skowhegan took several hours. I had no idea how beautiful the country was through New England. Reaching the grounds of the Skowhegan School on Lake Wessarunset, I felt very blessed. I had my own studio space and shared a room with 1 other student. I had the summer away from my part-time jobs in the hot streets of Manhattan just to paint. Visiting that summer was a figurative artist, Willard Majette. He gave a slide presentation of his large-scale, unromantic city scenes featuring life-size figures. The scenes were candid and everyday. They showed people descending escalators, coming through revolving doors, city people. He recently had a long residency in New Mexico where he painted an extensive mural on the walls of a purpose-built private gallery space. I made sure I talked to him after the presentation. I expressed my excitement and admiration. I wanted to know more about the New Mexican situation. He was a studious-looking man, dressed like a college professor. He lived and worked in Brooklyn with his wife Sally and their children. He was about 40. He suggested I stay in touch, as there might be some work for me in his studio. Also teaching that year was the charming Paul Ressica. Paul was an expansive, charismatic character who painted in a simplified, semi-abstract manner. When he liked a student's work, he would exclaim enthusiastically, "Simply marvelous work," sounding very much like an Englishman. His opera-singing wife accompanied him that summer. She could be heard practicing as he worked outside by the lake. 1976 was the bicentennial year, and that July 4th, we drove into town in Skowhegan, where I witnessed my first July 4th fireworks celebration. The summer was packed and full of hard work, love affairs, cocktail parties, arguments, summer stock theatre, debates, music, sunshine and swimming. Every Friday night we had a party in the school's hall. I sometimes danced with a young hot artist from Manhattan named Eleanor Sisto to Earth, Wind and Fire. She was a dark-haired, self-assured, Robert Crumb proportioned beauty, but I was not in her sights. I'd been in the US for a year and had not yet had a lover. I was randy but lacked confidence. Instead, I drank too much beer with my new friend Hilary, who was the other scholarship winner. Neither of us saw any action that summer, but we became firm friends. I did win a prize for painting, a $50 Utrecht certificate for art materials. That meant a lot on my small budget. The end of summer 1976 marked the end of my first year in Manhattan. My Skowhegan experience was over, and it was back to art school for the fall.